Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. Today you'll learn about the performances of Mendelssohn's Elijah at Davies Symphony Hall tomorrow night and Saturday, with an ensemble from the Piedmont East Bay Children's Choir, the San Francisco Choral Society, under the direction of Robert Geary. Two of the soloists are here to talk with me as well. We have pop iconic duo Marilyn McCoo and Billy Davis Jr. 50 years ago, they released Up, Up, and Away. We'll talk about their tour of that song and some memories of the past 45 years plus together as a couple and 50 in the showbiz of the fifth dimension and beyond. Also, two cast members from Something Rotten at the Orpheum will be with us. Stay with us here for Open Air today, if you can. Well, it's a pleasure to welcome back Robert Geary, Artistic Director of the San Francisco Choral Society. Bob is also founder of Volti and the Piedmont Boys and Girls Choirs and Director of the Golden Gate International Children's Choral Festival. He's a champion of contemporary music. Maestro Geary and his choirs have earned numerous national and international accolades and have performed throughout North America, Europe, the United Kingdom, Russia, and the Far East. Bob, welcome back to Open Air.
Hey, David. Thanks. It's great to be here.
Also with me is Tennessee native Edith Dowd, who made her New York City opera debut as Effie in The Ballad of Baby Doe and subsequently sang many roles with that late great company. She appeared with Santa Fe Opera, Sacramento Opera, and the title role in Carmen with New York's Bel Air Music Festival, as well as with Pacific Repertory Opera. Her many international appearances include companies in Germany, France, Japan, Taiwan, and the Spoleto Festival in Italy in the role of Juno in Semele, which led to an invitation by composer and festival founder Giancarlo Menotti to perform the role of Madame Flora in his opera La Medium, directed by the composer himself. Recent performances include the Long Island Opera, New York Lyric Artists, and the Santa Rosa Symphony. She'll perform the role of Mary in Der Fliegende Holländer with Livermore Opera next month, and in November she'll be heard as alto soloists in Beethoven's Ninth Symphony at Carnegie Hall. Edith, welcome to you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Of course. And we're also, I'm surprised that we are actually in the presence also of Eugene Brancoviano, who has been a guest of Open Air before. Eugene is a graduate of the American Institute of Musical Studies in Graz and the Universität Mozarteum Salzburg. He's also a recent winner of the National Young Opera Singer Competition in Leipzig, the International Music Award in Lundberg, and the International Opera Contest Ferruccio Tagliavini. I think I got that right. Among many, many other awards, Eugene's a mainstay, not only in the Bay Area, but internationally in many roles in opera and oratorio. Eugene, welcome back.
Hello, how are you doing?
Good. Just say that again. Just say hello.
Hello,
again.
How are you doing?
Oh, okay. I'm okay. I'm
just a little, shivers your timbers.
I know. I'm a little verklempt at the moment here.
That's how I got married.
And we left an empty chair for Elijah, just in case. Bob, Elijah is just one of two oratorios from the extremely prolific Felix Mendelssohn, the other being the more rarely and earlier composed St. Paul. Now, this is a dramatic oratorio. Could you mount the pulpit for a moment and give us the preacher's cliff notes of the story of the prophet Elijah and what makes Mendelssohn's presentation unique?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. You know, having visited this piece a few times over the last 25 years, I love it. I think it's masterful. I think that the one thing that kind of puts it a little bit ahead of its time is that it explores the progression of Elijah, the human being, from his battle with the prophets of Baal. And, you know, being a left coaster, I used to be somewhat troubled by the idea of one religion fighting against another religion until Carl Jack, who sings with our choir and is a biblical scholar and a conductor himself, enlightened me a little bit and enlightened the chorus that the Baal worshipers were actually into child sacrifice. So if we look at the evolution of the idea of God, getting rid of the gods that were into child sacrifice, we have to all agree, is a really good thing. So now, when we go after the prophets of Baal, I do so with a vengeance. My stick is flashing like a saber. But in the process of several of the adventures of Elijah's life, including bringing rain after the great drought and reviving the child who had died, the widow's the child, he also sinks deeply into depression at times. He's persecuted. He has to go into hiding a couple of times over the course of the oratorio. And he says, "It's enough. I'm done. I'm finished. Take me up. Take me away." And he is saved by the voices of children called the seraphim, reviving him, lifting him back up. And so the idea of delving into the psychological lows and highs of a human figure gives us, I think, the interpreters, the, you know, choir, soloists, orchestra, opportunities to personalize it and make it a little richer experience for the listeners and for ourselves.
So where did Mendelssohn pull the texts from then?
Yeah, he worked with the same guy that did the St. Paul, and I don't have my notes clearly in my head, but they had real success with St. Paul, and then Birmingham Festival, I think, asked. He had started working on the next one, which was Elijah, his second and only other, as you point out, oratorio. And they put it aside, but in the meanwhile, Birmingham Festival in England asked him if he could present a new oratorio. So they brought it up with that same librettist. He was working on the libretto as well, but they then translated to English. So the premiere was in English, which has set a tradition. And I'm told that Elijah is performed more in England than the Messiah is.
Wow.
Even to this day. So it had its start there. When you hear the German, of course, it adapts to the music somewhat better, and there's always room for improvement in the English translation, but it's quite good, and it's actually better than most, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's written for full orchestra and offaclide. Have an actual offaclidean player?
No, we have bassoon.
Bassoon.
Tuba.
Tuba, yeah. It's from the bugle family, I learned. Yeah. I didn't know much about the offaclide.
We didn't go that deep into performance practice.
It's funny. I mean, of course, we'll keep things on Elijah, but my friend Brian Holmes is a professor at San Jose State and plays French horn with the Peninsula Symphony with me. And I was just looking up on the offaclide in Wikipedia, and he had actually published one of his poems, which goes something like this. "The offaclide, like mortal sin, was fostered by the serpent. Its pitch was vague, its tone was dim, its timbre rude and burpent. Composers in a secret vote declared its sound non grata, and that's why Wagner never wrote an offaclide sonata." It goes on for a couple other verses, but he's very clever.
Sounds almost like a baritone's verdict of tenors.
Well, you could write your own poem for that one, right, Eugene?
The rhyme scheme gets more challenging, but yes.
Well, Edith, when did you first come to this oratorio in your own repertory?
Actually, when I was 16 and first studying voice, I sang "O Rest in the Lord," because that's a standard song for young singers with a lower voice. So I had familiarity with just that aria. But other than that, I had not had much familiarity with it at all, and I'm so happy to be able to do it now
in
such a wonderful place. But because it's real alto writing as well. It's not like the Verdi Requiem, which is mezzo writing. So it's a whole different approach to singing for this piece. It's very low, and I don't even think it goes above the staff ever. Mm. But it's very moving to sing it. Mm-hmm. I must say.
And you actually have a couple of different roles that you sing.
I do.
as contralto.
In this piece.
In this piece,
yes,
yeah.
The angel is one and the queen another. Mm-hmm. So a messenger. The messengers.
Indeed.
Of good and bad.
Yeah. And Eugene, when did this come into your repertoire? When did you first perform?
Well, this is going to be my fifth time singing Elijah. And just four and a half months ago, Lena Chanakas and I performed Elijah in a fully staged version of it at the Hammer Theater in San Jose with, you know, we had 80 people of and the chorus, full orchestra, 12 dancers, fantastic mm-hmm. projections. And it was, I actually shaved my head completely bald just to give it, you know, an extra edge.
Well, at least yours would come back. Yeah. I don't think mine would come back.
This was the most aerodynamic Elijah I've ever sung. And but seeming very similar. Yes, chilling. Just like Edie, for me, Elijah came into my life rather early because I needed an oratorio piece for my audition at Curtis Institute of Music in Philadelphia way back in 99, and my voice teacher Neil Seymour suggested Lord God of Abraham. Mm-hmm. And I immediately fell in love with the piece, because when I first heard oratorio, you know, my young opera singer's mind started to cringe and I didn't want to do it. Then I heard and I thought, wait, this is oratorio as well? And you know, it sings itself so beautifully. It's a real tour de force. And just last night, as we were rehearsing it with Maestro Giri, I honestly didn't want the rehearsal to end, you know, and we were already going, you know, further and further and further, and I just love every single second that I get to be, you know, swimming in this lavish piece, because it's just, you know, it's like you ride on a wave.
Mm-hmm. Well, in addition to the beautiful solo work, of course, we have the San Francisco Choral Society as the main accompanying figure, the main event of Mendelssohn's Elijah Oratorio. Conductor Bob Geary, tell us about, we're going to do things out of order here. So from the second half, the chorus, Behold God the Lord Passed By. What is that? Mm.
So we're processing, I have a little bit of chatter in my phone here. We're processing earthquakes, floods, and fires at this point. And it's actually a beautiful message. The chorus, the orchestra describes, it sounds a little bit like the opening of one of Beethoven's piano sonatas, actually. I'm sure it's an homage. But the orchestra describes a great tumult, and then the chorus sings about the wind and the fire and the flood. But at the end of each episode, it says, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. The Lord was not in the fire. The Lord was not in the flood. And then at the end of the movement, it says that the Lord appeared in a still small voice. And the setup with all the drama of the three cataclysms is so beautifully balanced with this much more meditative and melodic idea at the end of the movement. So,
let's hear that, and then we'll have more with Maestro Giri and my guests.
Thank you.
Behold God the Lord Passed By from the second half of Mendelssohn's Elijah, Opus 70. That from a 2005 recording of the San Francisco Choral Society under the direction of Robert Geary, who is my guest this week on Open Air, along with baritone Eugene Brancovianu and contralto Edith Dowd. That's some really neat writing. Now, Bob, you said that you've come to this four or five times in over the years. How has your approach to the work changed?
Interesting. I have to say that the craftsmanship that Mendelssohn puts into all of it, into the every vocal and instrumental line, and his sense of timing, etc., is so masterful that as a conductor, I'm still learning ideas of pacing, ideas of nuance, how to illuminate text, dramatic moments in text, whether they're quiet or not quiet, with what the orchestration is. So I think it's a slow deepening, and the idea of relating a little bit to the character, to Elijah's progression through it as he engages with Jezebel or with the widow, or you know, goes through his various tribulations and triumphs, that just kind of sensing what Mendelssohn was trying to reveal in human nature through the arc of the piece is, I think, a constant evolving process.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm happy to say I loved the recording you just played, and you've worked with the Choral Society yourself. I was delighted with what I hear, but I will say that was some years ago, 2005, and the chorus has progressed quite a bit since then, so it should be really magnificent.
Well, I certainly enjoyed working with you for King David and witnessing the chorus. It has really evolved tremendously. Edith, any discoveries on this version of or the way that Maestro Geary is approaching the work, or anything that you've discovered in this particular delving into the work?
Well, since I haven't had a lot of experience singing this with orchestra before, so I'm new to it. But working with him, and I feel like I can really sing full out. And it's not operatic singing necessarily, but it is full dramatic performance mm-hmm. and delivery. And having all these breaks in between when I sing, too, that's another interesting mm-hmm. thing about
yeah.
the performing.
You should be off stage, but it's an oratorio, right?
Yeah. Having a drink.
And Eugene, you've approached this several times.
So
is this more standard? You mentioned that you did a stage version of it. This is more in concert.
Yeah, but, you know, Maestro Geary has this Machiavellian skill of making music feel like it was written yesterday, and it's just fresh, and I get to sit within 2 feet of him. And it's as if he
okay,
becomes
okay, Eugene, you'll be hired again, okay?
Yeah.
Don't worry about it. You've got a great voice.
Mean, the thing is, you know, when he's conducting, he's like a human Faraday cage. And there, you can feel the energy and just gzz, and you cannot help but, you know, be in the slipstream of that. So hats off to you, Maestro. But every time I get to sing it, I discover a new depth of me being surprised at how deep I get to, you know, scrape the barrel of my own consciousness, so to speak, when you commit to singing something like It Is Enough or Lord God of Abraham. Notice also that Elijah, as a saint goes, he talks to the Almighty in a very different way. You know, there's one moment when Elijah literally says, have respect to the prayer, O Lord my God, unto thee, be not silent to me. He almost speaks with God's voice, as if, you remember when God speaks to Moses and gives all these orders, and here is Elijah speaking in an imperative,
talking back, yeah,
and you know, putting it on stage as we did with Lena Chanakas a few months ago felt tremendously liberating. This was the second time we had fully staged it. Before, I had staged it in Stuttgart, and then the time before it was also standard setting in Salzburg. So this is a standard concert setting, but it still feels just as free, maybe because of the experiences I've had.
Eugene Brancovianu is the baritone soloist, along with Edith Dowd as contralto. Tenor Brian Thorsett, who's been a frequent guest on Open Air, is also the soloist, tenor soloist, as Marnie Breckenridge on singing soprano with an ensemble from the Piedmont East Bay Children's Choir, all under the direction of Robert Geary, the San Francisco Choral Society's presentations of Mendelssohn's Elijah are Friday and Saturday at 8 p.m. at Davies Symphony Hall. Thanks so much for coming in and talking about this incredible piece of music that you'll, and especially seeing it and hearing it in Davies Hall. It'll be really something. We're going to go out with the final chorus from the first part, Thanks Be to God. Thanks to be to my guests as well.
Thank you, David.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks be to God.
Rousing Thanks Be to God, the concluding the first half of Mendelssohn's Elijah, Opus 70. That was the San Francisco Choral Society's 2005 recording under the direction of Robert Geary. Performances Friday and Saturday at Davies Symphony Hall at 8 p.m. sfchoral.com. www.ctfestival.org for more information. Well, that tune could very well be the theme song of my next guests. Thanks be to God, as a way of two very spiritual people in the room with me now. But you'll more likely recognize them from this tune. That was Up, Up, and Away, the song that launched the careers of my next guests, Marilyn McCoo and Billy Davis Jr., as lead singers in the Fifth Dimension, back in a very turbulent 1967. They are solid gold pop royalty, with 7 Grammys and a slew of other awards to their credit, not to mention a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. Post-Fifth Dimension solo and duo careers have kept this power couple going some 50 years later, with a marriage approaching that many years as well. They're in town for a series of 3 engagements at Feinstein's at the Nick. Such an honor to have you in the studio, and thank you for being so gracious for taking the time.
Thank you for having us. We are delighted to be here.
Well, I was reading your book, Up, Up, and Away, from a few years back, your story of your life up to, I guess, 2005 or so, so we need some updated chapters,
right.
I think.
I know.
Right.
The book is old now.
Yes, it is.
Well, Marilyn, you wrote that about that 1,000-watt smile when you first met Billy, and he still's got it, doesn't he?
He does, doesn't he?
Well, you know, I don't even know about it myself. You know, it's just the way I smile, I guess.
Marilyn, you also wrote that you loved singing from a very early age, and that if a visitor were to come to your home when you were in elementary or junior high, you would make them sing, you would make them listen to a tune or two before you'd let them go. Now, is that still the case now? Is that what keeps you going after all these years, need for that recognition?
You know, just loving music and having it as a part of my life has just been such a blessing, and now that it is part of my life, my working existence, I don't have to make people sit down and listen anymore. You know, if they are able to come and enjoy our performances, we love that because it really brings us joy.
She just makes me sit down and listen. You know? How about this baby? You know?
Oh, yeah. Well, Billy has always been one. I always have him listen to what I'm doing or trying to do and say, is it working or do I need to change it? And Billy has always helped me with my songs. He helped me with One Less Bell. He helped me with Wedding Bell Blues. And, you know, he's
good to have around.
Oh yeah, he's multifaceted.
I'm more than a big smile.
Well, let's take you back significantly, even before Up, Up, and Away. You mentioned that in order to get a first tune out, you had to do a cover tune. Talk to us about, for people that don't know what a cover tune is, everyone from the Beatles to the Rolling Stones actually performed someone else's music before they could do some of their stuff that they could call their own.
Oh, yeah, before you become a recording artist and you're just trying to get off the ground, you want people to hear you, and you're doing stuff that you know, stuff that you've been doing out there in front of people, giving it your best, you know. So that's what you call cover tunes. And so when you go in the studio, you have to do somebody else's stuff, and you hope that you can do a job better than what they did, you know, which a lot of times is very hard.
Well, for instance, you know, our first, our actual first top 20 record was Go Where You Want to Go, which mm-hmm. was a cover tune of the Mamas and Papas. Papas. It was a song that was on an album of theirs, and it was not, they were not going to release it as a single. And Johnny Rivers, if any of your listeners remember him, Poor Side of Town and Secret Agent Man, he had big hits back back in the 60s, and he had a record label. And he signed the group and brought us Go Where You Want to Go and said, I think you should record this song. It's going to be a hit. And we said, that's really not us. He said, it's going to be a hit.
It's not going to be a hit, man. It's not us. We don't sing like this. And he was right. It was.
Yeah, yeah. And then, of course, Up, Up, and Away, which just took Up, Up, and Away in every respect.
Oh, yeah.
Went off the charts.
That's right. Well, Jimmy Webb had written that song, and we were working on our first album after the success of Go Where You Want to Go. We mm-hmm. were finishing the album, and one day he was playing Up, Up, and Away for us, and we said, oh, what a wonderful song. It's so happy and makes you feel so good. We'd love to record it, and we'd love to put it on our album, but of course it'll never be a hit.
We stopped saying that.
Well, it sort of served as a tonic to the rather grim headlines that were coming out of 1966-67.
Yeah. You're right, because there was a lot of stuff going on during that period.
Yeah.
And we were right in the middle of it. And then there was groups like the Buffalo Springfield and Jefferson Airplane and all those groups. There was a lot of protesting, you know. And here we come with Up, Up, and Away, Flying in My Beautiful Balloon. It was like, who is this, you know?
It was kind of a nice escape from hearing about the protesting of the mm-hmm. Vietnam War. And just singing about being happy.
Yeah, yeah, that's what it was.
Mm-hmm. And Billy, you wrote that to get that tune, or I don't know if it was that tune or some other tune that you mentioned, where you had your friends and your family call the radio station and say, play that tune by the fifth element or whatever.
Yeah. The friends and family, sometimes it was us. we call it, hey, well, this is Dr. So-and-so-and-so, and you know, you got that tune going on by the fifth dimension. Would you please play that song Up, Up, and Away? You know?
And so it's kind of like the modern equivalent of accumulating likes on Facebook,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
That's the only way that should happen. Now, without revealing bank account numbers, talk to us who are out of the biz for what does a hit like that mean to you? As you mentioned that you could quit your day jobs and you could quit the evening rehearsals, now you could rehearse during the day and you could concentrate on your careers once a hit like that went crazy. Does that mean there's a ka-ching every time it's played? Is it a contract thing where you get a certain amount of dollars per sale? Or I don't understand how that works.
Well, it depends upon whether or not you've written the song.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
and if you've written the song, then there's a ka-ching every time it plays.
Yeah, right.
It doesn't matter who records it, you make the money. But Jimmy mm-hmm. Webb did very well with Up, Up, and Away.
Oh, yeah.
And for the fifth dimension, for the group, it meant that we had work, mm-hmm. that we could quit our day jobs, and that people would hire us to come in and perform in their club, perform concerts. And so it just opened up the world of possibilities for the group.
And you know, the only time it becomes major money is if it starts to sell like these groups do today, is when they sell platinum. You know, it goes on. It's huge, you know. And
back in the 60s, it was a different story.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. I mean, you still. The model of the industry is very different.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But I mean, it was still wonderful because you got a chance to start doing what you had always wanted to mm-hmm. do, which was what we wanted to do was sing.
Yeah, yeah. And people would want to hear that tune.
That's right.
Five Grammys just for that tune, including Record and Song of the Year. Mm-hmm. End of the day jobs, fantastic. right around that time, Marilyn, that you were starting to see Billy in a different light. You were always friends, but let me quote this from your book, Up, Up, and Away. Up, Up, and Away was released in late spring of 67. One time I was checking out an outfit Billy was wearing. A white satin shirt, blue and white plaid pants with the bell bottoms and white boots. His blue and white plaid pants caught my eye because they were snug and fit him well, and he also moved very well on stage. Wow, Billy
now, why
is kind of sexy.
Why did you pick that? It makes me sound very, very dangerous.
It makes Billy sound dangerous, too. What are you talking about?
Well, you were, dear. No, but we had a good time. We really did. We still enjoying that today.
Well, yeah. One of your early gigs was here in San Francisco at Bimbo's.
That's right.
That's right. Yeah,
that's right.
That's right.
And
Bimbo's
that was,
365 Club.
That's right.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And that was actually the beginning of our relationship coming together.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever we come back to San Francisco, there's so many very pleasant memories that we enjoy when we get here.
Well, especially for this 50th anniversary of the city of the Summer of Love, and
this is
coinciding
where,
with the Up, Up and Away.
Hey, this is where it all started.
Yes,
you know when doing what was it? The Mount.
It was the weekend of the Summer of Love.
Summer of Love. Yeah,
and
right.
The Fifth Dimension was our record company told us that we should perform at this weekend event that was going to be in Sausalito up on Mount Tamalpais. And so we went, and it was just scores of people. I was asking Billy, what was his memory of that moment?
All I remember is the place was huge. It was huge, and there were, I mean, people everywhere. And
hippies.
And there were different stages, you know. I mean, it was just, it was so much life just happening right there.
Yeah.
And then they had this big balloon. So I knew that was about us.
Oh,
you know,
nice.
Right.
So it was fascinating. And Jefferson Airplane was there, and
the Doors,
and Sonny and Cher, and it was mind blowing for us, because that was our first music fair experience.
Sure. Buffalo Springfield.
Yeah.
Damn.
Wow. That's right.
Something's
wow.
happening.
Yeah.
And you, it was also, believe it.
It was also a time of just the, you know, the three networks, you know, and where you could be seen and experienced by so many more people than 100 different channels and trying to get attention. You know,
that's
you,
right.
You
that's
have a
right.
hit like that and you can,
I know.
Can move forward.
And it's so amazing that here we are 50 years later with still the impact of that particular weekend being felt by the country and by the world, because the music festivals continue on 50 years later.
Mm. Wow. And even before Bimbo's, before Up, Up and Away, you sang together at Disneyland.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Yes, we did.
You really got into the book, didn't you?
Well, one thing I really took out of the book especially is that you always had the time for each other. I mean, your relationship is that 47, 48 years?
48 years.
48 years going. That's,
yes.
That's pretty, but as you mentioned, it's not always sunshine and flowers. Perhaps an occasional bad breath or bad behavior.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, we still have that. You know?
Well, you know, we always, when we wrote that book, we wanted to use that book to encourage people in their relationships that everybody goes through struggles, and that just because you don't happen to get along at a certain point doesn't mean that you're supposed to break up. You know, you try to work it out, especially if you like each other.
Yeah, I'm working on that. I'm 30 years in, and I'm like,
all right. 30 years is great.
Right. I remember when our management company came to us and said, you know, you guys should write a book. We said, about what? He said, well, you know, about your relationship. He said, you just been married, what was it, 30?
Oh, gosh, let's see. How long was it?
35
been?
Years?
Yeah, we had been married almost 35 years.
Almost 35 years, and you're in the entertainment field. You got a lot to say, you know. And we thought about it and said, I guess we do.
You talked earlier about how, you know, people don't know what a hit is going to be.
No.
Is there a way that you, is there a tune perhaps that you thought for sure was going to skyrocket but fizzled? Or likewise, like, wow, this tune came out of nowhere and it's a number 10 or it's a number 2.
Well, it's so funny you would say that, because we were just talking to some people outside about Aquarius Let the Sunshine In. When we first heard that, we felt it would be a hit for us. We didn't know nobody else that had never had a hit on it. But we felt that if we did it, it would be a hit. And that's probably the only one that we really, really hit.
Uh-huh.
You know?
And actually, we heard it at a production of Hair. And we got very excited about it and called our producer and said, Bones Howe is our producer.
Yeah, right.
Bones, we just heard a song. It's Aquarius, and we know it's going to be a hit. We just believe it's going to be a hit if we record it. And Bones said, well, I don't know. You know, a few people have recorded it. It's been released. It's never hit.
Yeah.
But he went back. He said, let me listen to it for a while. He came back with the idea of putting it together with Let the Sun Shine In. And that made the difference.
Mm-hmm.
Nice, nice. We'll go out with that shortly, but let's talk a little bit more about what else is on your hands. What else is in store for this 50th anniversary celebration of the Up, Up, and Away tour? Where else are you heading, or have you been?
Well, you know, we are really excited about being here with it because San Francisco is celebrating it like, I think San Francisco really has the focus on it more so than other places in the country because it started here.
Yeah.
The energy was here. San Francisco had a tremendous impact on the music industry because mm-hmm. of that period.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're really celebrating it mostly here right now.
Fantastic.
With the music that we're doing at Feinstein's and in addition to sharing, you know, the rest of our lives with our audiences.
But, nice. You know, San Francisco had a lot to do with the beginning of that was the start of all the music festivals.
Yeah.
You know, and now the music festivals are still going on now.
That's right.
You know, and all that stuff happened here in San Francisco.
Well, let's listen to one more tune before we let the sunshine in. Tell me about One Less Bell to Answer. That was such an iconic tune for you guys.
Well, One Less Bell was a song that Bones Howe brought to the group and said that he thought we should consider recording it as an album cut. No one ever expected it to be a single. It's a Burt Bacharach, Hal David song. And the interesting thing was it was we listened to the demo and Dionne Warwick was singing it. And we said, Dionne Warwick? Singing this Burt Bacharach, Hal David song, and she didn't record it. And but I loved it. And Bone said, I hear you doing it, Marilyn. And I've always loved torch songs. And that, to me, is the consummate torch song.
Let's hear a little bit of it, and we'll be back with you.
One less bell to answer. One less egg to fry. One less man to pick up after. I should be happy, but all I do is cry. No more laugh. Oh, I should be
great Marilyn McCoo and One Less Bell to Answer with some coaching by Billy Davis Jr. on that tune, the Fifth Dimensions classic recording of that. That just melts my heart. I just love it so much, Marilyn.
Thank you.
It really meant a lot to
Thank
me.
Thank you. I still enjoy singing it.
That's nice to know. Well, you've met and sung for at least one Pope, several presidents, a decent count of Grammys and other awards. What's on your bucket list? I mean, is there anything left? What do you guys want to be doing these next few years?
Well, we want to get back in the studio. We're not finished. Well, we enjoy it so much until we just feel like we still got a lot to give, you know. And so we're still out there. We still enjoy singing, and we still enjoy singing together.
Yeah.
Well, you talked about the honor of singing for the president in 1969. Even though it was President Nixon and the war was raging and a lot of your friends probably criticized you for that.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
Now, regardless of the politics, when the president calls, you answer. Would that be the case now or not?
Well, there's a lot of strange stuff going on right now. I mean, this is a different world, a different time.
Right.
It is.
Well, that's a hard one to answer, really. Yeah. But it was beautiful singing for the Pope. You know, a lot of people say, well, you know, you sung for the Pope. I say, well, yeah, but why did you sing for the Pope? I said, well, you know, he's a man of God.
Yeah.
We're not Catholic, but we, you know.
But we honor him as a man of God. Why wouldn't we sing for the Pope?
Right. Exactly. Well, you're singing for a great crowd at Nico's, at Feinstein's, these for three performances. Feinstein's at the Nico.com. That's N-I-K-K-O. Feinstein's at the Nico.com for more information. Marilyn McCoo, Billy Davis Jr., when the moon is in the seventh house, we're going to... be pleased that you're not aligned with Jupiter and Mars, but aligned with San Francisco.
Yes.
Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, David.
Amazing. Aquarius still sounds as fresh and relevant today as it did almost 50 years ago. Marilyn McCoo and Billy Davis Jr. at Feinstein's for three performances. Feinstein's at the Nico. We're going to back up a little bit more than 50 years next. I think the year is 1595.
So dull and mundane, that was so Middle Ages, that was so Charlemagne. Welcome to the Renaissance, with poets, painters, and bon vivants, and merry minstrels who show the streets of London a strumming their lutes
in puffy pants and pointy leather boots.
Welcome to the Renaissance, where we ooh and ah you with ambiance. We're so progressive,
the latest and the greatest, we bring it to you
with much ado.
Welcome to the Renaissance,
where everything is new.
Welcome to the Renaissance, indeed. That's the opening track from Something Rotten, Broadway's musical comedy smash. It's at the Orpheum Theater through September 10th. In addition to three principal cast members from the Broadway production, two Bay Area-born actresses, Julianne Godfrey and Christy Kerwin, are an important part of the touring production of Something Rotten, now at the Orpheum, through September 10th. Nominated for 10 Tonys, this completely original new musical has music and lyrics by brothers Carey and Wayne Kirkpatrick and tells the story of brothers Nick and Nigel Bottom as they struggle for success in the shadow of the great, self-aggrandizing, self-parodying William Shakespeare. Ensemble member and understudy for the role of Bee, Julianne Godfrey hails from Fremont and studied dance early on, later completing her undergraduate degree at UCLA's Ray Bolger Musical Theater Program, where she graduated Phi Beta Kappa magna cum laude with a BA in theater and an English minor. She also studied Shakespeare abroad in London and Stratford. Good training, perhaps, for a show that has Shakespeare as its central character. In New York, she was seen in productions and workshops of Disney's Frozen, Top Hat, and Valley Girls, as well as a pre-Broadway run of the SpongeBob musical and productions at Goodspeed, Paper Mill, Arena, Sacramento Music Circus as well. Welcome to you, Julianne.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
And nice to have you. Brisbane native Christy Kerwin is also a Sacramento Music Circus veteran, where she received lovely reviews as Billy Bendix in Nice Work If You Can Get It. She's an NYU grad and was seen in the Broadway production of Spamalot. Other show credits include Dames at Sea, Anything Goes, South Pacific, and White Christmas, among others. Welcome to you, Christy.
Thank you so much.
It must be so much fun. I saw the production on Broadway a couple years ago when it was first there, and forgot how much fun this show is. Definitely a break from the news of the day. So tell me, the national tour, where has this production been? And tell us a little bit about the process of how you got the gig. Let's start with Julianne.
Sure. We auditioned in New York for it, and I was actually at a dance call first, so they'll call you in for an appointment with, gosh, it felt like 200 other New York girls, all of whom are my friends. And
That's hard.
Yeah, so there was a series of callbacks, and then they had me come in and sing for Bee, and then come in and audition again to make sure everything was good. And yeah, so I got the call around September, and we started rehearsals in December for about a month, and then we teched the show in Schenectady, New York, which was very cold, and then we opened officially in Boston mid-January, and we've been on the road ever since.
Well, California girl, yeah.
Yeah.
Very,
not
better, used to Schenectady, How about you, Christy?
Pretty much about the same. Auditioned. We probably were in the same room together.
Yeah, we were. I remember seeing you in the hallway.
Yeah. Yeah. And I also went in for covering Bee and Portia, which is what I do on the road as well.
Right.
And we're having a great time.
Nice. Julianne, you're covering Bee as well?
Yeah.
Do you ever have some sort of a Eve Harrington moment or a Tanya Harding moment where you... As much as you love, I'm sure, Autumn Hulbert as Portia and Maggie Lacus as Bee, maybe hoping for the flu to come through, or maybe Black Plague.
Those two women are incredible. We love Maggie and Autumn, and they've actually never called out in 8 months. They're pretty. They're beasts, we like to say. But they're amazing, truly, just wonderful women.
Are you putting a call out for a Tanya then? Is that what
No, I mean, I'm sure my mom would say, you know, hey, Maggie, if ever was the time to be sick in me this month.
It's hilarious that you're saying Tanya Harding, because I grew up as a figure skater in the Bay Area.
Christy skated, yeah.
I skated in Belmont growing
that's
up.
Amazing.
Yeah.
But no, we love them.
Well, I mentioned the Black Plague because that is featured in a great, ill-conceived Bottom Brothers production number, by the way.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So tell us what else goes on in this incredible musical. It's a bit of a rivalry between the Bottom Brothers and the rock star, and he's really portrayed as a rock star, Will Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm. That hooligan, Will Shakespeare, yes.
The Bottom Brothers have some sort of an idea to get some, or is it Nick Bottom that gets the idea from a soothsayer to try something different?
Exactly. So they're trying to compete with Shakespeare in a time where Shakespeare sort of dominated the stage, and they're trying to write a hit that will rival his, and they decide to write the world's first musical without giving away too much, I think.
Yes.
And then hilarity ensues.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a great tune about the sentiments of Nick and Nick, more Nick than Nigel Bottom, called God I Hate Shakespeare.
Yes.
We'll hear in just a moment. Yes. But what other cities will this be taking you guys to?
Los Angeles is coming up, right? We're hitting the West Coast now.
Yeah.
We started off on the East Coast. We hit a lot of cities in Florida, and now we're kind of hitting Seattle's coming up as well.
Denver, yeah. Mm-hmm. We kind of worked our way through North Carolina and South Carolina and then Texas for a month.
Nashville.
Yeah, Austin, Houston, Dallas,
Pittsburgh.
Kansas City, yeah, Omaha.
Yeah, we've done a lot.
All over.
So a lot of cities I'm sure that you've never been to.
It's yeah.
Kind of, must be kind of interesting and exciting in
totally.
some cases and kind of scary in others.
Oh, yeah, it's
you
fun.
Know what? It's been kind of amazing because we have a very flamboyant, exciting, loud, crazy show, and a lot of these areas are fairly conservative, and I've been amazed by the really positive response almost everywhere. I don't think we've ever had a bad crowd, you know, that's booed us or anything. They're all on board.
Well, and you got such great family here supporting you, too. I'm sure you've got family and friends coming to the show.
Yeah.
Such a treat,
well,
yeah.
We wish you a great run here in San Francisco and wherever it takes you.
Thank you.
And come on back when you have a chance to talk about your next moves.
We will.
Thank you so much.
We're going to go out with God, I Hate Shakespeare from Something Rotten, now at the Orpheum.
Oh, God, I hate Shakespeare. That's right, I said it.
No.
I do, I hate Shakespeare.
Why?
I just don't get it, how a mediocre actor from a measly little town is suddenly the brightest jewel in England's royal crown. Oh, God, I hate Shakespeare. His plays are wordy, but oh no, the great Shakespeare. That little turd, he has no sense about the audience. He makes them feel so dumb. The bastard doesn't care that my poor ass is getting numb.
How can you say that? How can you say that?
It's easy, I can say it. Cause it's absolutely true.
Don't be a penis, the man is a genius.
His genius is he's fooling all of you.
But he's brilliant, what majesty flows from his pen. His poetry soars like a sweet violin. God's own inspiration, like lightning doth strike him. And he captures my soul.
Ah, jeez, you sound just like him.
Really? Thanks.
You should hate Shakespeare.
Well, I don't. I try to emulate Shakespeare.
Well, there's your problem. You're so blinded by the bard who's such a pompous little man.
Why is it a problem to admit that I'm a fan?
Cause he's a hack with a knack for stealing anything he can.
How can you say that? How can you say that the man really knows how to write a bitchin' play? You wish you could pen one.
We wish we were in one.
I just wish that he would go away.
Well, that's not gonna happen, because everybody I know says that he is the greatest writer that England has ever known.
And that's another thing I hate about Shakespeare, is all the twits who bloviate about Shakespeare, and how they prattle on about his great accomplishments, well, la-di-da-di-da. And once they start their gushing, there's no stopping on them, then it's blah, 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 Shakespeare. And he walks in, his dum-da-dum, ta-da, Shakespeare! He's holding court, and they say, Will, you're such a genius, and your writing is divine.
By any other name is such a clever line.
And they're all ooh, and he's all stop. And they're all yay, and I'm all ah. And I'm really getting sick of it. And oh, I hate Shakespeare.
I think by now we sort of know you hate Shakespeare.
Shakespeare, the way he feigns humility when all he does is gloat. The way he wears that silly frilly collar around his throat. The poster child for why no one should ever procreate. Let me make a shorter list and I will give it to you straight. Every little thing about Shakespeare is what I
hate. He hates, he clearly, surely, really, truly hates Shakespeare.
Don't hate.
From Something Rotten at the Orpheum Theater, now through July 10th. Local girls made good, Christy Kerwin and Julianne Godfrey among the cast. SHSNSF.com for more information. I'm David LaChalib. You've been listening to Open Air here on Local Public Radio, KALW San Francisco. My thanks to Niels Swinkles for producing the show. A reminder that our shows are archived at KALW.org. You can send me a suggestion for a future segment by sending me an email, david@kalw.org.